production I was appeared in at Deer Creek as something. I don't know, like a bug or something. I have to find it.
Okay,
it's buried among 50 million things, but it's just a show. I have no memory of it at all. We were all, I suppose, forced into doing a play, a pageant of some kind.
The reason we're
I played something.
Very interested in Deer Creek is that Myrtle Harrison, who was the owner of the camp, is in our oral history.
Okay.
And she was my aunt.
And she was Mary's aunt.
Okay, so everything ties together.
It all ties in together. Richard, still with you regarding your childhood, your developmental years, would you comment any more of your life at Shadyside Academy?
Well, Shadyside was an interesting thing for me. From a Jewish point of view, there were no Jews in the class until I was in fourth grade. And then the first Jew appeared, Peter Berman. And then there were no more Jews until I got to Shadyside Academy, the senior school, which was grades at that time 8 through 12. They didn't have what they now have, which is the middle school in Fox Chapel. So I didn't really know any Jewish, it was of course an all-boys school, so I didn't know any Jewish boys except Peter Berman, who at that time I didn't like that much anyway. And then my years at Shadyside Junior School were, the typical kinds of things. I did pretty well. My grades weren't bad. I had some difficulty with a few of the teachers, one of whom, Mr. Wood, was a particularly bizarre fellow. I once, sorry to say this, actually, he caught me cheating. I was actually, looking at some kid's paper, and he made me on my, 11th birthday, stand in the middle of the room with this kid, and we would hit each other over the head with pencils for a half hour.
That does sound weird.
Isn't that weird? So we did that. Okay. He was a rather sadistic teacher. He made a student run up and down a very steep hillside at Shadyside Junior School in full football gear on a warm day. And it was not a nice thing, and I never understood this. He was a young guy. There was a teacher named Mrs. Steeb, who I liked in fourth grade, and Mr. Hubbard, who I didn't like in fifth grade. A teacher named Mrs. Dockerty in second grade, Mrs. Clancy, boy, I can remember all these names, Mrs. Clancy in first grade, and Mrs. Logan in kindergarten. In kindergarten, I was told that I was constantly reminding the teacher of the time. I was, even then, oriented toward the clock. One time when I was in first grade, I said something like hell, and the teacher made me wash my mouth out with soap. Oh, these things that go on when you're in school. But generally speaking, school for me was okay. I played baseball in seventh grade, and Stevie Schwartz taught me how to stand at the baseball thing and not get scared when the ball came whizzing past. I appeared at Forest Hills on the first team and struck out. The pitcher was so good, we all struck out, and I never got a hit. I always played right field because that was the place they put me on because I wasn't good enough to play anything else. I also played soccer at Shadyside Junior School, and in my seventh grade year, I blossomed and became president of the school, student government at school. My grades were very good. I appeared in, and I was always appearing in plays. From the very first play I appeared in 1946 as a bee, in a play I rolled out on the stage as a bee. Then later on, I did other plays each year, and then in my seventh grade year, my father was very pleased. In my sixth grade year and my seventh grade year, I did two Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. One was HMS Pinafore, in which I played a little girl, and there's a picture of me, there's a picture of me in a hoop skirt and a bonnet, and all these boys, same thing, and they were some of the toughest kids at Shadyside at that time. They're all dressed in bonnets. My father thought that was hysterical, so he got the postcard. I think I told this on another tape. I think so. And he, yeah. Maybe so. Anyway, it doesn't hurt to remember it again. Mm-hmm. And he he got the Post-Gazette to bring a photographer out to Shady Side, and they took a picture of it. Then, the next year, my seventh grade year, I did Pooh Bah in Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado. And it's a very strange Pooh Bah, and he had a photographer come out and take a picture of that, too. And I had to sing, "Behold the Lord High Executioner, a personage of noble rank and title, a dignified and potent officer whose functions are particularly vital." Okay, that's enough of that. Thank you very much, ladies. But then, of course, that's, you know. So grade school was interesting. We went to Gettysburg in my final year and on a field trip, and I really did begin to blossom. Then I went to Shadyside Academy Senior School, and in the first year, I remember that we were all supposed to wait on tables. We had luncheon, and we had to wait on the tables, and this rotated every 10 days, and you had to pick up all the plates and take them in the kitchen. And I noticed that the senior class, they would sit at the head of the table. I noticed that at the table I was at, the senior would help out the young freshman. So I just assumed that if I piled up the whole plate tray, he'd do the same thing, and they didn't. And I dropped all the plates all over the floor, smashed in a million pieces. Now, I got very scared because a tradition at Shadyside was that if you crossed the senior campus, you had your pants taken down.
Oh, wow.
And so I assumed that because of this infraction, this would happen, but nothing happened. And I remember that day I was so upset, my father had to drive out to Shadyside to pick me up and take me back home. I just was, you know, I didn't know what had happened. And of course, when this did happen, the entire cafeteria applauded, you know, because that was a great thing. So my first year at Shadyside was okay. I think my grades were all right, but I had some difficulty with one of the teachers, Parker Berg, who I never liked, and he never liked me, and we never liked each other the whole time I was there. He used to throw pencils and erasers and books at students, and, you know, it's just incredible. And then when my father died the next year, it made it even more difficult for me to be at Shadyside, and my studies just went down the drain, and I began to do badly. And by the time I was in 11th grade, I was just about flunking. I flunked chemistry and geometry. I was doing very, very badly. And my mother decided to take the bull by the horns, and she stormed out to Shadyside to ask my geometry teacher what was wrong. But suddenly, everything went better. And by the second part of that year, my senior year, I blossomed, passed the geometry class, passed the chemistry class, and there were 55 students in my class. In my 11th grade year, I was 50th in a class of 55, and by the next year, I had jumped to 10th. Wow. And then I won the Richard S. Simon Improvement Award, which I got upon graduation from Shadyside Academy High School in 1958.
Who was Richard?
I don't know. He was an alumnus of Shadyside, and he. I had a great final year at Shadyside. I joined everything. The students liked me. My grades improved tremendously. It was like a complete transformation from 11th grade to 12th grade. And when I graduated, I was all set for the University of Pittsburgh, which I entered in the fall of 58.
Now, you mentioned early on you were the only Jewish student, and then another one came. Were there quotas at that time at Shadyside, do you know, for Jewish?
I have a feeling there were. I'm not saying absolutely there were, right. But I think there were. And by the time I got to Shadyside senior class, there were now 5 Jews. And I remember before my father died, because he was a big shot in town, so he decided to try to get somebody in.
So there was.
And he failed. One of the big disappointments in his life. He couldn't understand why he couldn't do this. And yeah, I think there were quotas. You know, you could never prove it.
Were there any black kids?
No. And there was also, I believe, though I'm not sure about this, but I think there was a quota on Catholics, too. But later that changed, and of course now there are black students and
girls.
And girls, my God. Holy cow. And African American, yeah. The whole issue of Shadyside changed considerably from that point in the 50s to now.
Well, I mean, that's throughout the country. I wonder what other questions I have. I know what I want to ask you. Richard brought a whole portfolio of letters, photographs, memorabilia. Do you want to talk about any of them?
Well, I'll mention the Gershwin thing.
Yes.
My father and mother were friends with George Gershwin, not you know, intimate, chummy friends, but they were friendly enough so that when Gershwin came to Pittsburgh in 1933, he performed with the Pittsburgh Symphony. I think he probably did the Rhapsody in Blue, and he brought Oscar Levant with him, who was at that time the supreme interpreter of Gershwin's music. And so my father was friendly, good friends with George S. Kaufman, the American playwright who had done You Can't Take It With You and written many other plays. This letter was sent to my grandmother on November 14, 1933, and signed by George Gershwin. Dear Mrs. Rao, George Kaufman sent me the note you wrote him, and I want to thank you very much for your generous offer to come to your house. I think it would be better to meet at your house after the concert on Sunday before train time. I will arrive Saturday morning for rehearsal, and perhaps we can meet sometime that day. I appreciate very much your offer to put your car and chauffeur at my disposal, and I may take advantage of your kindness. Looking forward to my Pittsburgh visit, I am yours very sincerely, George Gershwin. Well, what happened was that after the concert, he and Levant went over to my grandmother's house on Bartlett Street, and my grandmother had two pianos, an upright and a grand piano, and Gershwin sat at the grand piano, my mother told me, and Levant sat at the upright, and the two of them had a great time all evening playing the piano back and forth with a bunch of selected people. And you can imagine this evening in this woman's house, my grandmother's house. I was, of course, non-existent. I didn't exist yet. And what happened that evening, because it made the newspaper 2 days later, was that Gershwin broke her piano keys and they missed the train back to New York. So I guess he had to stay over. He didn't stay at my grandmother's house, but they had so much fun, they kept playing the piano. And I have this letter, which...
which we will copy and put into your file.
The other thing is that my the Enoch Rao Club...
Yeah.
Which we discussed, and I'm kind of vague on. This article appeared in New Yorker magazine, January 7th, 1991. Apparently, there is a Western Pennsylvania Jewish Sports Hall of Fame organization which meets every year. I don't know how long they've been doing this, but Barry Paris, who is a well-known writer, and he's written biographies of Audrey Hepburn and Greta Garbo, and he now writes film reviews for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He has a kind of historical bent to him, and so he wrote this article for New Yorker, and I'll read parts of this. A friend in Pittsburgh writes, a historic, if esoteric, event here went unremarked by the local papers. I am speaking of the 9th annual, well, there we are, there's the time, Western Pennsylvania Jewish Sports Hall of Fame Awards. Some 600 people showed up at Congregation Beth Sholem Synagogue for the affair, which every year raises thousands of dollars for athletic scholarships and other causes, sports causes. The speakers included Mayor Sophie Masloff, a bona fide Jewish grandmother, if not Jewish athlete, who gave a spirited, raspy rendition of the old Fifth Avenue High School cheer, Izzy, Ikey, Jake, and Sam, they're the boys that don't eat ham, go team. The crowd, as they say, roared. It had assembled to honor 5 living inductees and 3 deceased ones. Previous Hall of Famers have names like Ziggy Kahn, Bucket Sandemir, Buck Gefsky, Farmer Feinberg, Kingfish Elling, and my favorite, Shmola Levine. This year's live winners were football hero Izzy Weinstock, round ball coach Jule Rivlin, sports physician Dr. Joe Feingold, baseball's Lou Krause, and a basketball star of the 1920s and 30s named Wyoming B. Paris, who, by the way, is Barry Paris's father. Also known as the Masked Marvel, who at 80-something flew in from Kansas for the event. He still lives there. In his acceptance speech, Wyoming first warned his audience that in sports heroics, if not all human endeavor, The older we get, the better we were. Then, I like that one. Then, having agreed to a 3-minute limit on his remarks, he talked for 20 minutes, during which we learned that his parents immigrated from the Ukraine at the turn of the century, first to Pittsburgh and later to a sheep farm in Wyoming. When a son was born in their cave-like dugout on the side of a hill, they decided to honor the new world by naming him after the state. Wyoming historians confirm that Wyoming Benjamin Paris was the first Jewish boy born in that state. Some might have shrunk from such a name and changed it, or at least suppressed it. Not Y. He loved and later maximized the attention it attracted. Back in Pittsburgh in 1919, Y and his brother Bones and four other Jewish kids formed their own basketball club and named it after Enoch Rao, and that's my grandfather, a popular and in his day the only Jewish Pittsburgh city councilman. Y also played for Fifth Avenue High School, alma mater in those days of most Jewish Pittsburgh athletes, and of the pianist Witt Oscar Levant, Y's friend, whose brother Honey Levant was the family dentist, and whose neighbor, Mrs. Finkelstein, was, well, it was a close-knit community. The Rao team became Pennsylvania's most outstanding young, where the heck's the other, oh, what?
Okay, go ahead. We're continuing with the New Yorker article.
All right, let me repeat that sentence that stopped the tape. The Rao team became Pennsylvania's most outstanding young basketballers in that pre-NBA era of semi-pro teams underwritten by families or businesses that shared its players' ethnicity. The Rao's toughest rivals were the Duquesne Lafayettes, a Polish steelworker team. One night, when a Lafayette player hurled one too many ethnic slurs at Y, he sucker-punched the offender not once but twice. A riot erupted in the stands, and the police had a referee. It was the start of his reputation as a rough player. But Y prefers to call it the beginning of my long-lasting anti-Semitism crusade on the basketball floor. In 1927, Y's nose was broken during a game, and for some months thereafter, he had to wear a fearsome-looking protective face mask fashioned out of aluminum. Pittsburgh sports writers began referring to him as the Masked Marvel. The name stuck, and to please his fans, the Marvel went on wearing the mask for considerably longer than it really had to. So this is at least a little bit of the Enoch Rao in that thing.
We will copy that as well. Now you have some other things.
Yeah, now there are two other letters I'd like to read. One was addressed, my grandfather was involved in the 1913 with as a city councilman with the Carnegie Free Library on the north side, and he apparently had written Andrew Carnegie a letter, and Andrew Carnegie wrote a letter back to him dated April 25th, 1913. Dear sir, after consultation, this is to my grandfather Enoch, after consultation with Messrs. Walker, Wilkins, and Eggers, it gave me great pleasure to inform them that I would remit $150,000 as work progresses for the proposed extension of the Allegheny Library building. The Allegheny Library was the first erected by me in the United States. She may be considered the mother of between 24 and 2,500 libraries throughout the English-speaking world, which number is constantly increasing. I came to library building through the example of my father, who was one of the seven weavers in Dunfermline who combined their books, a few volumes each, and lost them to their poorer neighbors. No part of my work has given me more intense satisfaction than the bringing of books to the masses of the people. As Carlyle has said, a collection of books, quote, is the poor man's university, unquote. The pioneer stands commemorated by the status in front of your library. It was who opened his collection of books every Saturday, working boys, of whom fortunately I was one. Pittsburgh and Allegheny were the then separated communities, somewhat jealous of each other. Today I rejoice they are reunited and each has its library building. Nobly have they both maintained them. From every point of view, I derive intense satisfaction. The seed planted has produced a fruitful harvest. Thanking you and other members of the board and the staff of the library and rejoicing in your success, I am always your faithful fellow citizen, Andrew Carnegie. P.S. Having just dictated the above, Bertrand rises and brings an armful of applications for organs and libraries, etc., the pile a foot high, full scape size, and embracing just about 100 applications, all collected for favorable action this morning. So the good work goes on.
That's a wonderful
letter. The other letter I'd like to just throw in here, my grandmother, of course, knew...
No, one thing.
Yeah.
Your father, your grandfather at that time was on the city council.
He was on city council,
and
right.
And he was on a committee...
Probably the library committee, yes, exactly. Now, you can imagine how much $150,000 was in 1913.
Ooh.
Tons.
Okay, now you have another letter.
Another letter, which I thought I would read, that comes from the famous performer and actress and personality Lillian Russell to my grandmother. And unfortunately, I don't have a date on this letter, so... I mean, it obviously was probably around 1910 or 15. My dear Mrs. Rao, I want to thank you so much for the glorious roses. You are so sweet and full of the love of living. I know you shed joy wherever you go. I wish I could see you and have a better talk with you. Alas, the two-a-day keeps me busy. I shall be here in June for a few days, not working. Then I hope to have the pleasure of a visit with you. Meantime, I wish you all joy possible. Very sincerely yours, Lillian Russell.
Now, what preempted that letter? Your grandmother sent
She
roses?
Sent her roses. He must have appeared on stage here in Pittsburgh.
But they didn't know each other.
Not that I know of. Maybe they did meet.
Uh-huh.
But I do have in my possession somewhere a Christmas card that Lillian Russell sent to her. So they maybe they exchanged Christmas cards.
What's interesting is the Hotel Schenley.
The Hotel Schenley.
Yeah.
So she must have either performed there or was staying there.
And they probably sent flowers.
And the president
right.
was Roman H. Of the
Hotel.
Of the Schenley Hotel, but under the direction and management of the Carlton and Ritz Hotels in London.
Many.
Okay.
Now, of course, you understand there are many other letters, but I don't have them.
Now, Richard, I don't have any more questions at this moment. How about you, Mary?
Just would mention, you mentioned Joseph Feingold. He was the pirate's physician.
Yeah,
I
think
know,
so, yeah.
I think we should put that on.
Was right.
He was an orthopod,
yeah.
Definitely. Okay. He just died very recently. And then Sophie Nassau was the mayor for 2 years.
She was the last mayor of 4 years ago.
Right, there would be...
93, something. We have, for the record, we have Sophie Maslow in our tape collection as well. Richard, do you have anything else to tell us?
Well, I was trying to think. I'm going through this other list I have. I mean, there are other things I could think of, but in the fall of 1998, it's probably likely that I will be teaching at Point Park College. Both
that.
Film and drama.
Yeah.
And I will, of course, be performing Kraft's Last Tape this summer in
I'm
July.
Coming.
Now, since that announcement I gave you, one other thing has happened. A friend of mine who is a vice president of Paramount Pictures, who is an old friend of mine, she wants to come into Pittsburgh, produce it, have it professionally filmed, and then ship it around the country. She said, I'll become famous. So you now be at the end of, this is the last time you'll be able, you'll have to take a number from here on in when you're talking to me.
What's her name?
Lynn Ferro, F-E-R-O. She's terrific.
F-E-R-O.
Her first name is L-Y-N. And she has been very nice to me all through the last 15 years. She's married, lives on the West Coast, and she's very serious about being the executive producer of this film project, in which she films me for 1 hour doing this play, and then she has to secure the film rights from the Samuel Beckett estate, and then starts, as we say, peddling the film around to film festivals and so forth. I don't think that's going to work, but who knows? You never know.
Sundance.
Yes, Sundance, Telluride, the New York Film Festival. But this has been done before by many actors. And so I don't know if there's really a big market for this, but she's convinced, because she thinks I'm a very good actor, that this will work. So this just happened. So stay tuned.
Hot off
the who's it was.
Right.
And I'm also in the process of finishing a chapter of the Pittsburgh Playhouse history for a woman named Ruth Ann Malloy. She and her husband live in Fox Chapel, and they are compiling a history of Pittsburgh small theaters, community theaters, for the last 40 years. And my chapter will be on the Playhouse from 1934 to 1974 when it went bankrupt. And it's tough going. I'm still in the middle of it right now, writing and typing it. But it will be quite a document because it. She has now about 145 people have already submitted their entries.
That many?
Yes. Oh, there's hundreds of theaters in this town. Little ones. Now, a lot of them are gone, but did you ever hear of Characters East?
Mm-hmm. See? Not
that's right, you're not a Pittsburgher.
Yeah,
you might. Characters East. I mean, there are so many little theaters that have but they've flourished and then died.
I have a question. You mentioned last time about Ben Gross's theater. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, not much to tell you because all that my mother performed there in Don Brockett's reviews, and I went to see a Don Brockett musical there called Sweet Feet. I think I told you that, and that's on tape. And but I didn't. I mean, it was a big deal back in the old days.
It was like a dinner thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Good food.
Yeah, well, so I heard.
The theater and